Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, sitting in for Chris Boyd. So on one of my first days of Dallas about 3 years ago, I decided to do something crazy. I left KERA's studio on Harry Hines and started walking downtown. That's right, walking 1 mile into downtown. I hadn't made it a block before a driver actually pulled over to the side of the road and asked if I needed a ride. They thought I was crazy, and I thought it was crazy that no one would walk a mile. But after a few close encounters with speeding cars and then cases where the sidewalk just disappeared, I realized they were right. So is there any hope for Dallas to become a walkable, less congested city? Can North Texas get to be as friendly as to pedestrians as it is to SUVs? This hour, we're joined by a woman who would know. Jeanette Sadiq Khan is author of Street Fight, a handbook for an urban revolution, and was New York City Department of Transportation Commissioner under Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Thanks so much for coming on Think.
It's great to be here.
So you've done something that's pretty remarkable in this book, and you've actually made transportation almost sexy, interesting for sure. How did you get interested in streets and transportation in the first place?
Well, I grew up in New York City. And so as you know, every one of the 8.4 million New Yorkers knows, you know, you're a pedestrian at some point during the day. And so I grew up, learned how to ride a trike on the streets of New York and in the parks, and rode the buses and rode the subways. And actually, my great-grandparents were both in the transportation business, which I learned after I wrote the book.
Oh, wow.
But it's been really interesting because, you know, transportation really affects people's lives every day. It's about economic development. It's about sustainability. It's about mobility. Transportation, I think, is really one of the sexiest topics around.
And you're trying to convince people of that. So when you got hired by Mayor Bloomberg in 2007, what were your goals for New York City?
Well, I wanted to make New York City easier to get around by bike and by bus. I wanted our streets to be safer, and I wanted to create places for people to gather and enjoy and take it all in. And I was appointed in 2007 just after Mayor Bloomberg had launched Plan YC, which was this long-range sustainability program that looked at how were we going to design our city so that we continue to grow and thrive with a million more people that are expected here by 2030. And that plan had profound implications for how we designed our streets. We were not going to accommodate a million more people by double-decking our roads and double-decking our bridges. We really needed to look at the real estate of our streets and our infrastructure differently to make it more effective and more efficient. And that was really the lens through which I looked at the agency and the Department of Transportation.
Describe this traditional, I guess, anatomy of the street and how it was before you got there in New York City.
Well, you know, it's funny because we all tend to take our streets for granted, but the way that they are designed tells people how to use it. So in the book, Street Fight, we show how to read the street step by step. And the street is everything, you know, from building to building, the lines and the lanes and the signs and the signals. And they all are organized in a way that defines a street's operating code for how it should be used. So wide streets with wide lanes tell people in cars to speed, and streets with barren sidewalks and that don't have good crosswalks tell people on foot that they're better off driving, as you saw.
Yeah.
But there's a new road order in cities that's based on the idea that streets can be used for more than just driving. And the future of cities really depends on the decisions that we make today. And it comes down to choices. What kind of choices do people have for getting around? And a lot of people in cities say, well, we drive. We don't take the bus, and we don't walk, and we don't bike. And they think that people that do are motivated by some kind of politics, and people throw around, you know, this idea of those war on cars.
Yeah.
But really, these are, you know, when we put down the 400 miles of bike lanes, when we put down the 60 pedestrian plazas, the 7 rapid bus lanes, the launch of the largest bike share system in the country, Those are all about flipping the script in terms of how our streets are designed and who they're for, and building in choices, high-quality choices that make it possible for people to get around. You're not going to wish people onto a bus or a bike if it's not high quality and it doesn't get you to where you need to go safely, efficiently, and fast.
So one of the first projects you worked on was in Brooklyn, in Dumbo, and it was creating a sort of pocket park, and there's a photo of it, but describe what you were doing there.
Well, so we took an underutilized parking lot, just this, you know, place in the neighborhood, you know, where random cars parked. And over the course of basically a weekend, we took the cars out, we striped a curb, didn't build a curb, just painted a curb, and painted a green plaza, and put up some planters, tables and chairs, umbrellas, and, you know, immediately changed the use of the space. And it became a space for people to play instead of a place for people to park. And it showed the ability to move in real time to change your streets. It doesn't take billions of dollars. It doesn't take, you know, decades to get this done. You can do this quickly. You can use this effectively. And you can show the possibilities of the street. And the ability for people to see it and touch it and feel it and not go through years of planning studies and years of, you know, traffic studies. Changing the use of the space was key.
So a pocket park, you know, is one thing, and you did it, it sounds like, at a pretty low cost, fast turnaround. But you really had your sights set on something big, something that was none other than Times Square. And I knew this was massive, but it's a place more than 300,000 people pass through every day. What,
yes.
What did you do there?
Well, after we had done these projects around all over the city, we took our toolkit to really probably the biggest space around, certainly one of the most famous spaces in the world, Times Square. And Times Square was a funny place. People had been trying to fix it to make it safer and make it better.
Because it was dangerous,
for years. It was really dangerous. So, you know, Manhattan is on a grid, you know, north, south, east, west. And Broadway is the only street that cuts through that grid on a diagonal. And it does great things. It creates these plazas like Times Square and Herald Square and Union Square. But it also creates these kind of congestion hotspots. Very difficult to get through because you've got three traffic signals to get through instead of two. In addition, the street had been laid out so that 90% of the street was for cars, and yet 90% of the people going through Times Square were on foot. So the street was really out of balance. And so we really took a bigger picture view to say, how are we going to solve this problem that's basically been hidden in plain sight probably for 200 years? It was probably ox cart congestion.
your great-grandparents might have known about that.
Yes, they probably did. So what we did is we said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to take Broadway out of the system. We're going to close Broadway between 42nd and 47th Street. And we're going to try it as a pilot. We're going to test it out and see if it works. And if it works, we'll keep it. And if it doesn't work, we'll put it back to the way that it was. And we measured the impact of the change. We measured the mobility, you know, how was traffic moving? How were buses moving? How were people moving? Was it safe? What happened to the economics? And so all of those data points came into play when the mayor evaluated whether or not we were going to keep it or not. And it was really interesting because we found that as soon as we put up just the orange barrels closing off Broadway, people flocked there. It was like, I don't know if you've watched Star Trek, but, you know, when people materialize in a space, you know, you just dematerialize
just
on
filled.
The street. Just filled. I don't know where these people were before, but suddenly we had thousands of people there. And they loved it. You know, they were able to take in, you know, Times Square in a whole new way and see the sights and the signs and really it became a world-class space that was really worthy of its name, the crossroads of the world. And it was very funny because when we were doing it the night before, we realized that we had these cones up, but we had nothing inside. And we thought, oh, we have to do something. And so we actually went to a hardware store and bought hundreds and hundreds of very cheap $10.99 beach chairs. And we filled the space with beach chairs. And so, interestingly, the next day, everybody talked about the beach chairs. Did you like the beach chairs, the color of the beach chairs? And nobody talked about the fact that we'd closed Times Square to cars. So if you've got a big project that you're concerned about, I think you should throw out some beach chairs.
I see that they like to do that in parks. Or bring your own, you know, have one in the back seat.
Or bring your own, yeah.
And how did it work with the local retailers that were out, you know, that were in that area? What did they think of this idea?
It's a great question because, you know, when we first pitched it, you know, nobody likes to change the status quo, right? Especially the idea that you're here from the government and you're going to make things better is always greeted with a fair amount of skepticism. But the fact that we were testing it out and we were doing it as a pilot to see if it worked really was important in getting the buy-in of the local businesses and the theaters and the key stakeholders in the area, because they knew that we could put it back to the way it was before because we were just using paint and temporary materials. And that dramatically reduced the anxiety that people felt about this change. And the interesting piece was it had a huge impact on local businesses. We saw retail rents triple, retail sales triple. It became one of, Times Square became one of the top 10 retail locations on the planet. And it's not a surprise because it's when you make it easier for people on foot to get around, it's easier for them to pop into the store. They're not circling around for parking. So it's become an economic blockbuster. And it turned the local business people who had been some of our biggest opponents into some of our strongest supporters.
What cities have you learned from or were you drawing from for these ideas?
Well, when we were looking at implementing our bike lanes, I took a trip to Copenhagen and met with some of the leaders there, Jan Gehl, who's a very well-known urban planner. And I was actually able to see that one thing they did there is they did these protected bike lanes where they took the lane of parked cars, which are, you know, nestled against the curb, and they pushed it out. And they used those parked cars to create a parking protected bike lane, which was very easy to do, very quick to do. And you can preserve the parking, which was really nice to have as well, because people know, you know, when you take away a parking spot, it's like taking away someone's firstborn child. So anytime you can preserve parking, that's a win. And so it was very easy to do. And so we immediately came back to New York and implemented the first parking protected bike lane in the United States. And again, didn't take a lot of time, didn't take a lot of money, very easy to do. We also saw big impacts for local businesses. We saw over 50% increase in retail sales along the corridor where we put the parking protected lane in. And so, again, these kinds of changes, better streets are clearly better for business. And we saw that all across the city in every community.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about bike lanes, and it's an interesting case here in Dallas. You see it just starting to pop up in a minute. Right now, you're listening to Think on KERA. My guest is Jeanette Sadiq Khan. She helped transform New York City into a more bike-friendly, pedestrian-friendly city during her time as transportation commissioner there. She's out with a handbook for urban revolution, Ideas for North Texas as well. The book is called Street Fight. You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet. I'm at L Silverwoman.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like Margie Evans, nationally published creative writer. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. This hour, we're talking with Jeanette Sadek Khan. She's one woman who changed the way cities across the U.S. are thinking about their streets. She's author of the new book, Street Fight. Jeanette, some of Texas's biggest cities, like Dallas and Houston, are known for the very things that you say to avoid. Parking lots wide as Texas sheet cakes and highways with more lanes than a racetrack. Have you seen any cities like these become pedestrian friendly?
Well, actually, I think it's really interesting to see what's happening in Houston, which has enjoyed a new surface transit renaissance. And it's really showing other cities what can be done when you look anew at something as simple as a bus system and really look at new connections and build them out and make it easy for people to walk and take the bus. And they're enjoying great success. So I actually think that there's some really great lessons to learn from Texas these days.
So what is it that they're doing? I'm not familiar with in Houston.
So they've actually completely redesigned their surface transit bus system, and they have created a great network of new bus lines that takes them to major, whether it's a medical center, whether it's schools, whether it's major downtown areas. They completely replanned it, completely redid it, and it is a great model for other cities. Because when you think about it, so many of the systems we have, not just our streets, but also our transit systems, have been the same way for 50 years, right? Mm. We really have not changed them very much. And if you were in business and you hadn't changed the way you know, you used your major capital asset in 50 years, you probably still wouldn't be in business. So these kinds of upgrades, these very innovative approaches are making a big difference, because roads and transit systems don't update themselves like a smartphone app. You really need to do a little work to reimagine what they can be.
So a lot of people across the country, but here, call for wider highways and more toll roads. What does research show about how expanding highways, making them bigger, actually affects traffic?
Well, you know, the data shows, and it's 50 years old, that when you build more roads, you get more congestion. Solving congestion by building more roads is like solving obesity by loosening your belt. It doesn't work. And so we have to take a new approach. We're not going to be double-decking our roads and having a better quality of life and having better mobility. So, you know, the 405 in Los Angeles, one recent example, you know, they spent billions of dollars to, you know, add another lane, and it was immediately filled. And actually, traffic got worse on the 405 after the additional lane. So we need to look at our asphalt and our roads a little differently. We need to build in more mobility, more efficient and effective choices. And that's really what we did in New York. We built the kind of choices that people wanted for getting around. And, you know, there are a lot of people in cities that say, well, we drive. We don't take the bus, and we don't walk, and we don't bike. And they think that people who do are motivated by some kind of politics and this, you know, war on cars kind of thing. But what we found is if you build high-quality bike lanes, people will ride. We saw a quadrupling of bike ridership. If you build high-quality bus lanes, people will take the bus. We saw a 10% increase in bus ridership. If you build pedestrian plazas, you will make the city better for business, more enjoyable, and improve the quality of life. These kinds of strategies aren't just, you know, green, crunchy, environmentally friendly things to do. They are the core of a basic economic development strategy for cities, because people can move anywhere. And so the quality of life in your city is directly tied to the economic health of your city.
I do feel like some of it, though, I don't know, it has to be cultural. I grew up in California, and here in Texas, it's a pretty big contrast. I mean, people really drive from their mailbox to their garage door, and everyone uses valet. It's free in a lot of places. How do you change those habits?
Well, there is a big cultural component to it, but it is also a function of choice, right? certainly in New York, it wasn't like we just waved a wand and everybody said, oh, that's great. You know, we're all in love with these changes. Every single inch of the 180 acres that we reclaimed from cars in New York was a fight. And the reality is that changing the streets for people on foot or on bike or on the bus is a fight. And people have a reason why they can't lose a parking space or why they need more lanes. But you need to change the status quo. And to change the street, navigating that fight is a key part of the process. And it requires not just new design vocabulary for the street, but really a new vocabulary to describe the changes. And it takes political courage to try something for the first time and strategies to win the buy-in of the public. And it really does require changing that status quo. And it's both cultural and the design on the streets. But given the choice, people will choose better streets and better options.
You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Let's go to the phones now to Plano. Salman, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. It's interesting conversation you're having on the transportation system. I just wanted to share a quick feedback. I moved from England like 2 years ago to Texas, and one thing that kind of was very evident for me over here, especially on the highways, in England, you would have the big buses, trailers, trucks, whatever you want to call them. They would drive on the slowest of lanes, not the fastest of lanes. In the U.S., unfortunately, what I've seen is the trucks, the trailers, all these big things, they always are driving close to the fastest lane. And they are the ones who are overtaking and doing all sorts of things, which makes it very dangerous for drivers on the roads. And I was thinking there was a way out there if these safety practices could be implemented in the U.S. somehow, just to make safe driving for everyone.
Great.
That was just a
thanks for your comment.
Are you driving?
Oh, I'm sorry. Hold on a second. Let me go back to him here. We can. We might have lost him. I'm not sure. It sounded like he was driving, though.
He was driving. I'm hoping he's not talking on the phone and driving.
We have different laws on that here, too.
Yes, we do. But, I mean, he raises an important point in terms of the safety on our streets. And, you know, whether it's trucks or buses or big cars and vans, we really are plagued with congestion. And we have 33,000 traffic deaths a year. And that is a big problem, and we really need to be smarter about how we use the network that we have. I do think that there's going to be some promising work that happens with the advent of autonomous vehicles and autonomous freight lines, which can, I think, in the future really reduce some of the safety concerns and provide better mobility and faster delivery with the use of technology in that arena. But I do think it's really important that we really start to focus on the fact that we have people dying on our streets. It is a public health crisis. And, you know, we've really gotten what we built for. We built wide roads, and that led to unsafe behavior. So we really need to flip the design and really make it people-focused and not just about getting cars, you know, from point A to point B as fast as possible.
One of the biggest complaints you hear from people, and I mentioned it, is people who want to walk more has to do with the sidewalk situation. Mm-hmm. And here especially, they're cracking and uneven, skinny, and then sometimes they just disappear. A lot of places, we don't even have sidewalks, especially in North Texas. How hard is it to get better sidewalks?
Well, it's really important to, you know, you can stripe a sidewalk. It can happen quickly. You know, it doesn't have to take, you know, years and years and millions of dollars of capital construction to get that done. We certainly outlined the city that we wanted to see in New York using something just as basic as a can of paint. So marking out the space that provides for more than just the car is really key. And, you know, when a lot of people think about cities, they think about, you know, the skyline and museums and the rest. But really, the street is the fundamental operating unit of a city. And each one contains a code for how people should use it. And I think looking at a, you know, people-focused street design is really what you're seeing cities move toward. Even cities like Los Angeles, you know, you're seeing, you know, great streets programs that focus on pedestrians and more bike paths. And we saw major new plazas and parklets and people-friendly designs in Seattle and San Francisco and Chicago. So it's really an important way to look at the street. And when you look at the street from the ground up, you really go a long way to improving the livability, quality of life, and the economic performance of your place.
Who needs to buy in, though? Because it, like you said, it's hard to just have the government official come and say, okay, here's my can of paint. I'm just going to spray on where we should put sidewalks. And how do you get buy-in and really make it happen?
Well, we worked very closely both with through the Plan YC vision that Mayor Bloomberg had outlined to say we need to actually change how our streets are designed so that we are actually meeting the demand on them. And the bottom line is that if people don't have a choice, our cities don't have a chance of surviving. So we really need to move to these kinds of designs quickly. And I do think part of the answer lies in following the people. You know, people are an indicator species for the quality of the street. And when you see people walking and biking and hanging out on the street, you have the ingredients for a great neighborhood and a great city. And with those kinds of ingredients, you can reverse engineer the city that you want to see today. And so it is about, you know, having that larger vision, and it is about working with communities to deliver better choices, more affordable choices, more convenient choices for how they get around.
We want to take just a moment for some news that's just in, and we'll get to it later in the show. But Prince, the legendary singer from Minneapolis, was found actually dead today at his home in Minnesota. He was 57 years old. No word yet on a cause of death. You can stay tuned to KERA and NPR for the rest of the day for more on his life and legacy. But now back to our conversation with Jeanette Sadiq Khan. We're talking a little bit about streets and the revolution that you call it a revolution, which is a big word, but it's a hopeful one. Let's talk about cycling for a minute and bike riding. Here in Dallas in North Texas, people don't ride their bikes because they don't feel safe. How do you make the city streets safer for bike riders?
Well, it really is important to make space for bikers on the street. You know, you're not going to wish people onto a bike just, you know, saying it's important to bike. You actually have to make them a fundamental part of the transportation system and not just this alternative way of getting around. So in New York, we put down 400 miles of on-street bike lanes in 6 years. And it didn't cost a lot of money, and we did it very fast. And so it can be done. And as a result, we saw a quadrupling of bike riding in New York City. And you see, importantly, women, families, kids riding in these lanes. Because if a bike lane is safe for if you're 8 or 80, you've actually designed a street that will work better for everyone. And I think that it's really important to understand that when you build a better bike lane, you're actually building a better street. It makes the street safer for pedestrians. It makes the lanes more clearly defined for motorists. It really, if you really want to build a better city, you can start by building a bike lane.
But it seems like there's all these competing ideas and different approaches to bike lanes. And I've just, you know, when you travel from city to city, you see some have the protected lanes by concrete islands or the parked cars, as you mentioned. Some have mixing zones or just signs spray painted on the street. Which is best?
Well, it's funny. I think, you know, what you see depends on how you get around, right? Mm. I mean, people in cars think that it's all about the cars, bikes, it's about the bikes, and pedestrians about the pedestrians. But what we've seen is that when you build it, they will come. And more people cycling makes our streets safer. And, you know, after all of the changes that we did under the Bloomberg administration, we found that when you give people choices, people will choose better streets. And at the end of the administration, 74% of New Yorkers supported bike share, 73% supported plazas, 64% supported bike lanes. And so, you know, if you show the opportunity that's been hidden in plain sight in your streets and you actually, they can see and touch it and feel it, they buy into it. and it's always a challenge to make it work. But today there's a new status quo in New York, and you know, this backlash that we had, people saying, oh, you can't do bike lanes, you know, we're not Amsterdam, we're not Copenhagen. And I think it's funny that people in other cities are now saying, we're not New York.
So here, the city for bike lanes tried something called sharrows, basically painting arrows on existing traffic lanes. But nobody, and I'm a cyclist and a driver, and when I'm in either situation, I don't really know how to navigate them. Is there some sort of like public education that needs to happen?
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of sharrows.
Okay.
I don't think sharrows really offer the kind of protection that cyclists need, particularly when you've got a car-oriented city. You know, it can feel dangerous. You know, I've ridden.
It sounds friendly, though, with sharrow.
I know, it does. It sounds sparrow, like, yeah. Ooh, it's kind of fun, you know, kind of light and lively. Yeah. I'm going to do a sharrow. But you really do need to build safe infrastructure, and that's what it takes. People are not going to just get there because there's a line on the street that says, you know, that's got some diagonals on it that says go here. But you can design, you can use designs that are tailored to local geographies. We didn't have the exact same kind of bike lanes all over New York. We had protected lanes where they worked. We had parking protected lanes in other areas. In other areas, we just had striped green bike lanes. And, you know, you need to be very opportunistic about looking at the design of the street and what really works from an engineering perspective. But, again, part of it is looking at that street differently, that you can actually claim some of that asphalt for other uses, even by just skinnying down a traffic lane. I think there's virtual cities that are hidden in between these parking lanes that have really been used they've been designed from a federal design standard to work on highways, but not as appropriate for local city streets. And so, you know, repurposing that asphalt makes it actually fairly easy to find room for a bike lane or find room for a bus lane. And that was very much a part of what we did in New York.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. This hour, our guest is Jeanette Sadiq Khan. She's author of Street Fight, Handbook for an Urban Revolution, and she was New York City Department of Transportation Commissioner under Mayor Mike Bloomberg. You can join our conversation. Just call 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like former student Dr. Candace Bledsoe, educator and community leader in diversity and inclusion. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. If you think about the most valuable resource a city has, it's something that affects us every day. You might not think of streets. I know I generally don't. But my guest this hour argues streets are what define a city, what connect us to work and home, and they influence our decisions and moods as well. If you've ever been in a traffic jam, that's obvious. Streets are what we all share, and yet we talk very little about how to make them better. This hour, we're talking with Jeanette Sadiq Khan. She's a transportation pioneer who oversaw an urban revolution in New York City. Her book is Street Fight. So, Jeanette, talk to me a little bit about how you convinced people in businesses that getting rid of parking lots and doing things like that was an okay idea.
Well, the first thing we did was to set a vision of where we were going. So the idea that we were going to be growing as a city was very important to local businesses. How are we going to handle this growth? How are we going to handle the million more people that are coming to New York City by 2030? once people understood that we have to actually accommodate that growth, and we can't just have more and more parked cars and, you know, more and more congestion, that we actually have to do things a little differently, that was actually a very big part of the conversation. And after setting a vision for how we might get that done, building in more choices for people to get around, making it really easy and comfortable for people to get around by bike, making it really easy and fast for people to get around by bus, you know, making, you know, this city streets much more enjoyable, that was a really important part of that vision. And then we moved really fast. And instead of debating changes, you know, these theoretical changes and these models and these drawings, we worked very quickly with paint and planters and stones to transform places to show what was possible. New Yorkers had actually almost given up on the fact that their streets could change. We're still, like, working on a 50-year extension of the Second Avenue subway. So people thought, this is never going to happen in our lifetime. And so to be able to show that, yeah, you can change your streets. You can make them better. It can happen in close to real time was really important. And, you know, there's nothing more powerful than the proof of the possible. And so we did a lot of these projects as pilot projects to test them out, to see if they worked. If they didn't, we could put them back to the way that things were before. But you couldn't argue that everything was working just fine, you know, and that it wasn't worth trying a little experiment here or there. And so we did that work so fast, and people were able to see and touch and feel the changes, and they saw the benefits. And so we saw local communities love the plazas, love the bike lanes, and love the bike share programs, and started really demanding it. And they were the ones that started, you know, saying, I need a plaza in my neighborhood. I need to have a faster bus in my corridor. And so it really sort of flipped the script on the relationship that we had with communities where they were really driving the change and requesting these programs.
Let's go for a minute to the phones here. Let's go to Annie in East Dallas. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Doing good. I love the show, and I'm so happy that you're bringing up this topic. I live in Far East Dallas, right by the Arboretum, and the street Lakeland, which goes right into the Arboretum and right to White Rock Lake, is a nice sized street, and it's all residential, but there's room for sidewalks and there are no sidewalks. And I really want that, and I've been talking to people about what to do, and I wonder if you have any advice on how to get started on that.
Well, it's a really important point, Annie. And, you know, the idea of changing, you know, our space, you know, from places to drive into places that people want to be can start with something as simple as a sidewalk. And it certainly makes it safer for everyone. So we really worked very closely with the communities and the community boards in New York City. So working at that local level and starting to demand change and organize for that. And, you know, we've seen lots of different cities do different things. In Seattle, they were looking to do not a sidewalk, but they were looking to get a bike lane in. And one night, a group came in and started putting in these, you know, temporary bollards, and to make the case about how the street could actually be designed. And it wasn't very much longer until the city government came in and actually laid down that bike lane. So there's lots of different ways to go, but I think organizing and building support and reaching out to your local elected officials and political leaders is a really important start.
Well, we're getting lots of calls, so let's go now to another caller in Richardson. John, hi there.
Hello, how are you?
Good. How are you doing today?
All right. I was curious if any of, you know, like the services like Waze or Strava or Map My Ride, stuff like that, is that data available, like, to the city level that they can help design places that they already know people are using?
So you're, John, that's wondering whether we could use mapping data for planning?
Yeah, because I heard like Waze will like sell their traffic data, or they try to sell their traffic data back to the city so they can see where like congestions are or whatever like that, to maybe help plan better or do better stuff like that. And so I didn't know if any of that data was used, or if it all was just like local grassroots kind of stuff.
Thanks. Sorry, Jeanette.
Yeah, no, John, it's a really good point. Waze has partnered with a lot of cities to use their data to better manage city infrastructure. And I think that that wave of Waze is going to continue into the future. We didn't use that in New York City, but you're seeing city after city looking to bring data to the table to better manage infrastructure operations. And I think it's an exciting time for that.
So what do you think about congestion pricing? It's something that's more recent here in North Texas. We have a few expressways with it. How does it work, and where does that idea even come from?
Well, I think that there's no doubt that the infrastructure of this country is in a state of dire disrepair. I think the Society of Civil Engineers gives us like a D+, you know, on roads and bridges. And we are not seeing a lot of infrastructure investment at the federal level. We see the budget constraints that states and cities have. And so coming up with the funding to pay for the maintenance of our road and bridge and transit network is crucial. It's the economic lifeline of cities and states and the country. And we are only spending 2% of GDP on transportation. Other countries are at 5, 6, 9%. So what we're seeing is that cities are looking to help themselves. And one way to do that is to look at handling the demand differently and pricing the network a little differently. And so in congested areas, in the case of New York, we looked at putting a fee in for drivers that were driving into New York City at the peak period, you know, of the commuting time, and we were going to use the revenues to pay for the expansion and maintenance of our transit system. And it was interesting because when we proposed it, I mean, it had a terrible name, congestion pricing.
Yeah,
too bad. You know,
I
words
want
tied
of
together.
Those things. Yeah.
Right. Nobody wants congestion or pricing. Actually, the new plan in New York is called Move New York, which is a much better brand for this idea. So the idea is basically to, again, you know, charge drivers for coming in during peak hours of the day, particularly in areas where they've got a transit option. And then take those revenues, use them to maintain, you know, transit programs or other programs to increase the mobility choices for how people get around. So in New York, it was defeated. It almost passed. It didn't get voted on in Albany. But I really do think in city after city, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, because we cannot continue to thrive without investment in our transportation infrastructure programs. And you see the success of places like London and in Singapore and in Sweden, and you see, you know, big opposition at the beginning, and then you see huge support at the end of the day.
Let's go back to the phones to Sam in Dallas with a question for us. Hi, Sam.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
This is in regards to the comment earlier about how the widening of 405 in Los Angeles didn't really help congestion.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just wondering, so the answer, I guess, or the solution to that would be to invest in infrastructure, if that's right. And I was wondering if there has been any kind of successful case where you implement public trans or other types of other modes of transportation to a city such as Dallas, where it's sprawling. I mean, we're going from all the way from like Dallas all the way to Frisco and so forth. So I'll take my answer off there. Thank you.
All right, thanks. So any ideas for cities? What have cities done successfully that are sprawling with public transit?
Well, we talked about what the new surface transit renaissance mm-hmm. that's happening in Houston. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that, again, you know, downtown is a great place to start to focus, and then moving in other mobility options like really high-quality bus rapid transit is a great way to provide options for people to get around that don't depend on having to get into an automobile and, you know, sprawl further and further out. So I think that, you know, we're lucky to live in the 21st century because we know we've got 100 years of experience that we're not going to be building our way out of congestion. We really need to provide more choices for people to get around because, you know, the road can, you know, if more roads reduce congestion, then Los Angeles and Houston and Atlanta would be moving at highway speed by now. But there's really little to show for the billions that have been put into the construction upkeep, except for lots of brake lights.
So you obviously gave lots of advice to Mayor Bloomberg when you were working there for the city. If you were giving advice to mayors here in North Texas for how to get started on bringing in different stakeholders, communities, businesses to talk about plans in a big way, what would you say?
I think it really is about looking at the transformative power of streets in your cities. And there's more to streets than just cars and highways and stoplights. And people don't really realize that streets make up, you know, a quarter of the public space in cities. And most people don't really think about the way they're designed or even have expectations that they can be better. And so the point that you can actually, you know, paint the city you want to see, that you can move quickly, set a vision, move fast, measure it, give the power of the streets back to the people. It's really important. Changing the street is a challenge to the status quo. And when you push the status quo, it pushes back. You have to be ready to fight, but our streets and our cities are certainly worth fighting for.
Do you have a city that you wish you could work on improving?
Well, I have the fortune of working for Bloomberg Associates. Yeah. Mayor Bloomberg started a consulting firm, and we provide our services pro bono to mayors around the world. And it's been a very exciting moment to be able to help cities from Los Angeles to Oakland to Detroit to Rio, Mexico City. It's an exciting time because, you know, cities are where the innovation's happening. Cities are really what the future is all about. And so if we can remake, redesign, and reclaim the streets of our city, you know, that's going to go a long way to making the world a better place.
Is there any of those projects you're working on right now that you're most excited about or something where something really different is happening?
Well, it's very exciting, the work that we're doing right now in Detroit, taking an older, very, you know, it's Motor City, and bringing a different approach. That's more about people power and less about horsepower. And Mayor Duggan in Detroit is doing extraordinary work, and he's pulled together a great team of people to look at how do we redesign these 1950s streets? How do we make them better for business? How do we make them more sustainable? How do we make them more livable? And he gets that this is all about, you know, driving a better economic development program for Detroit. And so that's been really exciting work that we're just starting to get underway there.
Great. We look forward to hearing more about it. Jeanette Sadiq Khan is author of Street Fight, Handbook for an Urban Revolution. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Lauren.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Knabe. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. And with help on the phones today from Alex Smith, we also had help from Stephanie Kuo. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington, and you can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Thanks so much for listening, and have a great day.